Good Monday morning and welcome to Mountain Money here on KPCW. I'm Doug Wells. Renee Bodley is nursing a cold, so she is out this morning. And with me as my co-host is Bob Hendricks. Bob, good morning.
Nice to be here on this side of the microphone.
And this side of the beautiful weather. Boy, we had a nice weekend. It's a beautiful morning. We just heard on NPR News the folks in the Northeast are fighting their third major storm in 2 weeks.
We have a high today of 55, 60 tomorrow.
Well, if people from New York City aren't here yet for spring break, they should be heading this way to get away from that awful weather. We've got a great show this morning. Our first guest is Elizabeth Willer Woods. She is an author, and the name of her book is Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. Those of you that know me here in Park City know I have a reputation for being fairly frugal myself, so this is a topic near and dear to my heart.
Also coming up at 9:30, we'll talk with Mark Nelson of the Heber Valley Historic Railroad. A lot of changes, some great things going on there. We'll talk about that. Also coming up at 9:45 in studio, we have Honey and Blaine Parker. They have a business called Couple Co. That is coming up this morning here on Mount Money. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
This is Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. On the phone with us this morning is Elizabeth Willard Thames. She is the author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think I captured your last name incorrectly at the open, so I apologize for that. Am I pronouncing it correctly, Thames?
No worries at all. It's Thames, like the river.
Okay. All right. Well, again, apologies for that. So let's talk about your book, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. You know, oftentimes the topic is through budgeting or better planning. What do you mean by simple living?
For me, simple living really encompasses our holistic approach to our finances and to our life. So I embraced extreme frugality, which initially was cutting out everything that was not totally necessary in our budget. And then from there, after saving at a very high rate, I realized that I could simplify all the other parts of my life as well. And so I began to incorporate tenets of minimalism into my parenting, into the way that we operate our home, into the possessions that we own. For me, frugality really became a wholesale lifestyle transformation. So it was a question of, what are my highest and best priorities? And am I always using my time and my money in service of those priorities and letting go of the things that ultimately don't matter to me? So things that I would spend money on in the past or that I would waste time on, letting go and moving those things out of my life.
And the impact can be quite dramatic, right? You and your husband retired in your early 30s. You live up in Vermont on 66 wooded acres. You mentioned that you're a parent. So was that a goal that you had to retire as early as possible, or how did you get to that point?
Yes. So, and we define ourselves as financially independent, not retired. So we work on projects that are meaningful to us and that we enjoy working on. So, for example, I write my blog, Frugal Woods, and then I recently wrote a book that came out. So that's work, in a sense, but it's work that I absolutely love. And so achieving financial independence was a goal for us so that we would be able to pursue the lifestyle that we want to live, which for us is living on this homestead in the woods. So before we moved out here, we lived in cities. We lived in New York City, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, and we had very conventional 9-to-5 jobs, and we're living essentially the traditional American lifestyle. We were consuming things. We were trying to make ourselves happy and fulfilled through our spending. And what we realized is that spending money in an effort to make ourselves happy or in an effort to achieve contentment doesn't work. And so from that premise, we said, okay, what if we didn't spend money? What if we saved as much as we could and started working towards this higher purpose, this larger, more long-term goal?
You make it sound so simple for those of us who live paycheck to paycheck. How do you, did you have some help deciding what things to cut in your budget to do? How did you actually just begin? Start from the beginning and I cut this and then we went to this.
Sure.
And then what happened?
Sure, sure. So from the very beginning, my husband and I graduated from college, and we started with basically $0. So we were extremely fortunate to graduate without student loan debt. We went to the University of Kansas, so a state school, and came out very fortunately without debt. We didn't inherit any money, but came out without debt, started from zero, and said, okay, we're going to save as much as we can over the years. So as our salaries increased over the years, we continued to save at a pretty high rate. And when we were able to save enough to buy our first home when we were 28, and after that point, we didn't have a major financial goal. And that's when we started to spend more and get into some trouble. So I always encourage people, make sure that you have a goal for your money or it's going to slip through your fingers. So for us, defining that goal of moving to a homestead was very important. And your goal, your listeners' goals, will be different from ours. You know, you probably don't want to move to a homestead in the woods of Vermont. But there's something that I think everyone wants out of life more than just sort of slogging through it paycheck to paycheck. So think about where you really want to be and what you need to do with your finances in order to achieve that lifestyle. And so the first step in doing that, after you know what your long-term goal is to track your expenses. So what are you spending on every month? And I encourage people to use a free software program in order to do this. Don't guess. Make sure that you're looking at the actual dollars that you're spending every month. Go through it line item by line item and ask yourself, is this a meaningful expense? Is this something that I'm deriving a high return on my investment from? Is this something that's really getting me towards that longer-term goal? And if it's not, cut it out of your budget and see how much you can save in a month, in a year, in 5 years.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I like about what you just shared was, you know, evaluating, are you getting the joy in the experience that you want out of the money that you are spending? And I think that's important because sometimes I meet people that are doing what I call sacrificing unnecessarily. Did you find yourself in that situation as you'd review things? Maybe you cut some things out that in hindsight actually you really enjoyed?
Absolutely, yes. And so I actually offer a free challenge on frugalwoods.com. It's a month-long challenge to help you determine what you can cut out of your budget and how much you can save. So it's called the Uber Frugal Month Challenge. And what I discovered in doing this myself is that the first month is the hardest, and the first month the cuts are the deepest. So you're going to take everything out of your budget that you don't need and see how that feels. Then you have a really informed perspective from which you can evaluate that lifestyle. And then you can start adding things back in. So for a number of years, my husband and I did not go out to restaurants at all, ever, never. And that's something that we've actually added back in. So we now go out to a restaurant for dinner once a month. That's our special date night. We leave our kids at home, and that's a really wonderful evening for us. So that was an expense that we did decide to add back in. And so I encourage people to see how it feels to go without and then evaluate what it is that you would like to add back in with the full knowledge of how much you'll be spending and how much you'll be giving up in savings by doing so.
You mentioned your husband, so this is something that's going to have to, both of you are going to have to work very closely together. Did you sit down, say,
yes,
weekly or monthly and say, okay, let's look at this, what are we going to do? You do a little arm wrestling about,
yes,
what you're going to get rid of? How did that work?
Yes. So if you have a partner, this is definitely something you want to do together. It really encompasses our entire lifestyle, and so it impacts the whole family. And I think it's really important for you and your partner and your family to be on the same page and to be very transparent about what those goals are for the family, because how you use your money and how you use your time is going to dictate the type of life you have. And so having that understanding as a family unit of, you know, these are our long-term goals. We want to pay for our kids' college, or we want to be able to take that vacation together, or we want to move into a better school district. These are all things that you want to decide on together. And then when you're making these decisions to eliminate expenses, it becomes about what you're going to gain. So it's no longer about what you're giving up. It's really, oh, okay, I see, we're getting that much closer to this goal that we've set out for ourselves. And I do encourage couples to have finance dates. Sit down together. Make sure that you both fully understand your money. Even if one person in the partnership is sort of in charge of paying the bills and things like that, make sure the other person knows what your net worth is. They know how much is coming in and going out. And, you know, sort of in, offer that insight to each other so that you're both working from a place of understanding and knowledge. It's really a time for an open conversation, not a time for criticism. And so I think having that open conversation with your partner about money is really important. And ultimately, for my husband and I, it actually brought us closer in our marriage because it put us on the same page. We really became partners in every sense, and we were truly on the same team.
So you get to choose your partner in life. Kids don't get to choose their parents. And my notes say that you have a young daughter. You mentioned that you leave your kids at home, so I'm guessing you have several children right now. What about your kids? They're probably still young, but as they get older, as they approach 10 or their teen years, what about getting them into the loop? And they're kind of dragged along on this lifestyle, willingly or unwillingly, and how do you think about that?
So true, so true. So our children are very young. They're 2 years old and 3 weeks old, so they don't really have a lot of opinions at this point. But what's important for us is modeling the values and the lifestyle that we think is important for our children. So from this very early age, we model for our daughters that we do live frugally. We do live a simple life. We value the outdoors. We value time together as a family. We value volunteering in our community, going to church together. So I think through any lifestyle that you lead, the best you can do is live by example and demonstrate for your children why you're doing this. It's also true for us that our kids will live this way from the outset. So they will have this understanding of simple living ingrained from the beginning. We are also big believers in spending on our priorities. And so if in the future, for example, one of our children really wants to take, let's say, piano lessons, that's something that we would pay for. If that's truly something that they want to do, that would be an example of spending on our values and spending on our priorities. So again, having that enshrined as to what you do value and knowing where you're willing to spend money. So if our kids ask for brand new toys all the time, that's not going to happen. But something that would be enriching for them would be something that we'd be happy to spend money on. And I'm a big proponent with kids of save money on the easy stuff. You know, don't buy new clothes, don't buy new toys, don't buy new nursery furniture. Get used things from thrift stores, get hand-me-downs from friends. And then you'll have the money saved up to pay for those piano lessons and those hockey lessons later on that your kids really want to do and that are going to bring a lot of value to their lives.
As you go through this process and you look next door, you look at the Joneses and see what they have, was it difficult sometimes to say, no, we're going to stick to this plan? They've got a new car. They've got a new couch. Was it difficult to stick to the plan at times?
It wasn't because we were working towards this larger goal. So that's why I really encourage people to outline where you're headed in life. Know what that destination is, because a new couch or a new car is pretty meaningless. when you think about the trajectory of your life and what you want to do with your time here on Earth. Not to put it too grandly, but truly thinking in that broader context makes a new couch seem much less enticing, or at least it did for me. And another piece of frugality for me is recognizing a gratitude mindset. So I consider myself extremely privileged and extremely fortunate to be able to save money. For many people, they don't have room in their budgets to save money, and so I'm extremely cognizant of how fortunate it is to be able to decide to be frugal. And so having that gratitude mindset and that mindset of abundance really allows me to not worry about the material possessions that I might see around me.
You know, Elizabeth, let's talk more about that, because I think as Bob was sharing, you know, some of this is a keeping up with the Joneses mentality. And you're spending money, you know, I use a phrase, you know, people are borrowing money they don't have to buy stuff they don't need to impress people that really they don't care about. It's kind of funny when you think of every piece of that cycle, there's something wrong with. And like you, I have found that being grateful is the first step to breaking that cycle. Now, you lived in some towns where this keeping up with the Joneses is pretty prevalent, right? You mentioned Washington, D.C., Boston, New York City. Those are very competitive towns, particularly when you're young and you're signaling to other people how you're doing professionally. One of the things that I found here in Park City that I really like, it is an affluent community, but it's as much about the experiences that you're doing, the mountain biking, the skiing, the getting out for the hike, going out with your dog, as it is about anything else. And so I think that helps with that environment. I've got external factors that help me to be grateful. What advice do you have for folks to help them get that grateful mentality?
Sure, and I think spending on experiences is such a great example of spending on a lifestyle that you really value and that's going to deliver that high return of happiness. So I like to say that frugality is about living the life that matters most to you, not the life that matters to someone else. Because in the end, you know, the only person who's really going to care how you lived your life is you and your partner and perhaps your children and your immediate family, but it's, you know, living for someone else and living for sort of external validations is sort of a meaningless way to live. And I say that from experience because I think I did that for many years in my 20s. And it's something that I discuss at length in the book because it was a difficult transition for me to say, you know what, I have to start doing what I value and what matters to me, not the things that I see other people doing. And so I encourage people to really do that soul searching of, when am I happiest? When do I feel like I'm contributing my best self to society? And I think that you want to not let your spending prevent you from living the life that you want. You want to let frugality allow you to live the life that you've always dreamed of.
Well, and I think that's the quandary that I think a lot of, or the connection that a lot of people don't make. And it sounds like your 3 week old is chiming in, so I'll say good morning to him.
Oh, sorry, he's saying good morning.
Yeah, good morning. No worries at all. And you know, having just had a child 3 weeks ago, thank you for being with us on air. I know that really put your life. There's a lot of pieces in the air, but you know that connection. People think, like as I mentioned, I'm a fairly frugal person, and people, you know, sometimes will ask me, you know, isn't that hard? Don't you feel like you're sacrificing? And in many ways, it's empowering. Where I want to go with this is for people that maybe it's not natural for them to be frugal, how do they take that first step so that they can feel the empowering that paradoxically comes from maybe not buying everything on a whim?
Yes, it is so empowering. I think that's the perfect word for it. And I encourage people to do some math. So look at your expenses, like we talked about earlier. Figure out how much you could save in a month, and then calculate that out over the course of a year, 2 years, and then use a compounding interest calculator. You can find one online and see how much that savings would generate if you were to invest it. So I do recommend investing, and people have to figure out what works for their specific financial portfolio. But see how much money you would have in 20 years, in 30 years, if you were to invest those savings, because it's going to be a very high number. And I think that's something that many of us don't realize, that starting to invest in something like a 401k, in a retirement fund, when you're very young, will yield absolutely tremendous dividends in the long run. And it might only be a couple hundred dollars a month, but that can translate into a substantial retirement amount later on. And so have that broader perspective and have that concept of delayed gratification, of what your money could do over time if you weren't to spend it today.
Let me ask you a question. This may be a silly question, but as my wife look at young families, they're having daughters, and we're thinking, oh my, in 21, 22 years from now, that's going to be very expensive. How do you tell a daughter when she turns 22 and wants to have this big, lavish wedding that she can't?
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessarily different for daughters than it is for sons. And I hope that as a society, you know, we move towards greater equality in how we raise our sons and our daughters. And I think that, again, setting that example for our children from the outset, knowing what we value as a family and building on those values together is important. I can't answer, you know, how this will play out for us in the future, or even if our daughters will want to get married. That's certainly, you know, a decision that they can make much farther down the road. But I think it's also important to be able to spend on the things that you value. So for us, we're already planning for our daughters' college educations. And I think that planning for something like that is another great way to encourage savings in the short term. So we have 529 college savings accounts for both of our girls. That's something that folks can look into if they're looking into how to save for college for the future or for higher education, because it's much more important to me that we're able to, for example, pay for that than to pay for, like I mentioned earlier, new toys or new clothes in the short term. So have that longer-term perspective, you know, of what's really important to your family and of what you do want to be able to provide for your children.
Now that you have, and I'll put this in quotes, arrived, things change in your budget a little bit? You mentioned that you're going out for dinner once a month. Are you being easier on your budget now, or are you just still sticking to the same old thing every day?
You know, once we started living frugally, we began to see so many benefits beyond just saving money, that for us, it's really a choice to have frugality as our lifestyle. So frugality is environmentally friendly. It gives you more free time. It allows you to let go of perfection. It lowers your stress. It, you know, it really frees you from worrying about money. And so for us, it's a very joyful way to live. And this concept of simple living is really important to us, and it's really what brings us happiness day to day. So it's not a slog for us to save money. It's truly this conscious choice. And interestingly enough, we have found that it's actually more expensive for us to live rurally here on our homestead than it was to live in the city. And I recently published an article on Frugal Woods detailing the expenses of a year living in the city and a year living in the country. And it does cost us more to live here, but it's very much spending in alignment with our values and with the life we want to live. So I think as long as you're spending in ways that, again, bring you that high level of happiness, you know, then you are spending in a way that's consistent with your long-term priorities.
Yeah, I think the secret there is being deliberate and thoughtful in your decisions on how you're spending money. I want to share, this has got to be our last question, we've got to wrap up on this, but I want to share with you that one of my daughters is big into minimalism. I mean, she has 30 pieces of clothing, and she tracks that.
Oh, wow.
And so
that's
it's great. Yeah, and she has these various, and she's 15 years old, and so she has these tools that help her be thoughtful about what she wants and what she doesn't want. And one of the big things in this minimalism movement is tiny housing. And by tiny houses, you know, anywhere from 200 square feet to 500 square feet, which is truly, you know, the definition of tiny. And there's actually some discussion here in Park City, because it's a very expensive place to live, for affordable housing and using tiny houses. And it's been somewhat controversial. You know, people, there's been in general, I think, a fair amount of pushback for that. Running a blog, your blog is frugalwoods.com. Running a blog, I'm sure the subject of tiny houses come up often. Help us understand when a tiny house might be a match and when it might be a challenge for families.
That's a great question. So I do not live in a tiny house. I should preface that we don't live in a tiny home. I find it fascinating. I'm very interested in the movement. I think it's a wonderful way to reduce carbon footprint, to have more affordable housing. It's not something, though, that we have pursued. It is something that my husband and I have talked about doing after our kids grow up and leave the house. And so it might be something in our future, but I think if people are interested in it, there are many, many resources and documentaries out there of people who have lived this way and who have built their own homes. So I would encourage people to look that up.
Okay, well, we will wrap it up on that note. Our guest this morning has been Elizabeth Willard Thames. She is the author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. She also has a blog. You can find that at frugalwoods.com. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And stay tuned to Mound Money. Up next, we will have the folks from the Heber Valley Historic Railroad, and then after them, learning to work cohesively and happily with your spouse. Company is Couple CO. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Our newest residential project, Apex Residences, is a collection of 63 slope-side townhomes and flats located at the apex of Canyons Village at Park City Resort. Information about Apex Residences can be found online at apexparkcity.com or 435-429-APEX.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits. From business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database, becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Mound Money. We thank Elizabeth for joining us. She is the author of Meet the Frugal Woods. That was a great conversation. We are currently waiting for our guest, Mark Nelson, with the Heber Valley Historic Railroad. We will move on to our third guest and maybe just transition the two if we need to. But Bob, while we're waiting a minute or two, I thought I'd mention that on Friday, we had a jobs report. People probably noticed the market was up pretty strongly on Friday. And the reason for that is it was really kind of a Goldilocks type jobs report. It was a very strong jobs report. But what people are concerned with, what investors are concerned with, is inflation. We're starting to hear that a lot. Interest rates have started to tick up. People looking at mortgages, it's quite a bit more expensive now than it was 18 months ago to get a mortgage. So people were looking at the jobs report. And fortunately, it was a picture perfect jobs report. We had about 50% more jobs created than what people were forecasting. We had a little over 300,000 jobs created in the month of January, or I guess it would be February. And importantly, the wage increase was very tempered. Now, if you're an employee, that's not a good thing. But if you're worried about inflation, that is a good thing. And so we saw that be very well received by the investing public. And in fact, the wage increase remained a modest 2.6% year over year. And the country's really at full employment. Utah's been at full employment for a long time, but the country's now at full employment. Bob, do we have our guests or should we move on?
We do, but we might mention the word from Vail last week was minimum wage going up and also investors seeing a few more dollars. So things are going well here and for Vail across the country.
Yeah, actually, Vail reported their quarterly earnings, and it's no surprise that skier visits were down in Utah and Colorado, but because of their overall package of when a tourist is here, capturing more of those dollars while they're here, their actual revenue is actually ticked up a little bit. So the company did really well. And if you're an investor in Vail, the really good news was they increased their dividend by 40%, which is a very big increase.
Well, if you're a visitor to the area, one of the places I think you want to visit is the Heber Valley Historic Railroad. And on the line this morning is Mark Nelson. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Nice to have you on this morning. Let's go back and do a little history. As I remember, I used to call it the Heber Creeper, I think. It's not the Heber Creeper anymore. And what has happened along the way to this?
Well, you know, when the first train started rolling up from Provo to Heber in 1899, I'm told that it was very quickly dubbed the Heber Creeper because it went so slow. And that's been its nickname ever since. But it was originally operated by the Denver Rio Grande Western, and then from 1970 until 1989, it was a privately owned tourist railroad by the Ashton family, a local family in Heber. And since 1992, it's been an independent state agency of the state of Utah.
So back in the day, why was the railroad created, and what was its way to generate revenue? I'm imagining it wasn't moving people. It was probably more freight of some sort.
Well, it was actually from the very beginning what they call a mixed train. So it carried both people and freight. And from 1899, up until 1940, it was really the only practical way to get from Provo to Heber. You know, in those days, I guess the road up the canyon was very bad. And so there were two trains a day making the round trip in those days. In 1940, they completed the Deer Creek Dam and made Deer Creek Reservoir and also built a better road, and cars were much more popular by then, and that really spelled the beginning of a decline of it for both freight and passengers, and it just went downhill until the mid-60s when they abandoned the tracks for the Denver Rio Grande.
And give us the history. How long did it take to put that in initially? How many people worked on it? Just some of the stats. What were some of the biggest challenges in initially putting that in?
You know, I think one of the first big challenges was actually getting the permission to build a railroad at all. There was a consortium, a group that wanted to build a dam in Provo Canyon and a reservoir for hydroelectric power. And there were several court battles, I guess, in between 1895 and 1899, and Denver Rio Grande Western eventually prevailed. And then they went to work, and in 1 year, they built the track bed all the way up to Heber and laid the tracks. And so between the late 1898, and then on September 21st, 1899, the first trains rolled into Heber, and they said almost every resident of Heber was out there to watch it.
That was a big event. Let's move currently. The Governor's Office of Economic Development announced the winners of the Rural Businesses of the Year Awards. Businesses located in Utah's 25 rural counties are recognized for outstanding achievement, growth, impact in their community, job creation, and innovation. And Heber Valley Historic Railroad was honored in Wasatch County. You bring jobs. How many jobs to Wasatch County?
Well, not that many full-time jobs. I wish more. We just have... I think about 8 full-time permanent employees, but I think I think they gave us that honor because, to a lesser degree, during the summer months, but during November and December last year, we hired 175 high school kids who work on our Christmas train, and you know, it's that's a pretty busy time around here, and also last year was really the high water mark for the Heber Valley Railroad ever in terms of carrying passengers and number of tickets sold and revenues and things like that. So we had a great year last year.
You have different excursions depending on the time of year. Could you just kind of give us a recap of, I know the Polar Express because we've taken our grandkids on that, but I think that's the only one we've been on. What other things do you offer?
Sure. And so we really divide our services or our products, if you will, into two categories. One we call scenic trains, and those are the daytime trains that are primarily targeted towards out-of-state visitors. And those run year-round at 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Now, this time of year, until the end of April, we don't go every day. We just go Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. But then starting the last week in April, we go Tuesday through Saturday. And we also have trains on Monday nights and Friday nights. And a lot of our other products, including those two that I just mentioned, are really targeted at the Wasatch Front and the residents of Utah. And those are more family-oriented or date-night-oriented. And, for example, Friday nights, we have a different theme every Friday night. 2 weeks ago was the Broadway Show Tunes train. Last Friday was the Cowboy train. And this Friday's St. Patty's train. And so those are very popular. The Monday night trains, which is our most affordable, is kind of a karaoke sing-along thing, or those are all sold out during the summer months. And then you mentioned the North Pole Express, which is our Christmas train. Last year we ran 79 of those trains between the day after Thanksgiving and December 30th, and everyone was sold out with 450 people on it.
That's amazing, and you know I'm glad you talked about some of the date night trains that you have, because I don't think of the Heber train as being something, you know, that my wife and I would do. So it's a good reminder. I think of it, if you know, if I have friends that come into town with young kids, you know, for whatever reasons, kids are fascinated by trains, and it's a match for them. So I'm glad to hear that you have something for all age groups. The Heber train's also been featured in a number of pretty prominent films. I know I was watching a film and they were doing a scene at a old time train station, and when my kids were younger, I took them to the Heber train, and I remember thinking, that's the Heber train station. So what are some more famous movies that the train's been featured in?
Well, let's just go very recently. In fact, just this past week, we filmed a Mountain Dew commercial at the railroad. And, you know, it always surprises me how many people it takes to film a 30-second commercial. But that's another story. But anyway, they just did a Mountain Dew commercial and had some Mountain Dew dudes riding on top of the train, which we don't allow that normally, of course. But last summer, or in 2016, Netflix made a film called Deidre and Lainey Rob a Train, which did very well at Sundance Film Festival. And that was, almost all of that was filmed here. And then as we go further back, there have been lots of commercials and lots of movies. There's a docudrama called The West that was filmed here in 2015. I'm just trying to think of some of the others, but A River Runs Through It many years ago, and just a lot of other films.
If I'm not mistaken, you're running diesel-electric locomotives. Any chance of a big steam engine in any time in the future?
Oh, yes, and that's the most frequently asked question. I get asked that question every day, I think. Our number 618 steam locomotive has been in our shop since 2014, undergoing a major rebuild and restoration. And it's about 75% done. We're really hoping we get it out later this year, but I think it's more likely that it's going to be about this time during the first quarter next year. That should be back out on the tracks. We're really, really excited about that prospect.
Will that run each day or just on special occasions?
No, we'll use it in regular service. It won't run every day, but we'll run it, you know, for our scenic trains. And, you know, typically or oftentimes those steam locomotives, you'll warm them up, fire them up, and run them for 8 to 10 days in a row, and then cool it down, clean it out, let it rest for a few days, and then fire it up again. And we'll do something like that, but it will be in regular service.
Well, Bob's got a big smile on his face, so he's looking forward to that taking place. Mark, before we let you go, what's your story? How did you end up in the position that you're at? And has trains always been in your blood, or is this something new?
Well, I'm still wondering how I ended up here, to be honest with you. But
a lot of us are wondering for ourselves as well.
I always loved trains as a kid, but to be honest, in my adult life, no, my background was in aviation and simulation and a lot of other entrepreneurial things. But when I moved to Midway, I got to know, because of Midway Swiss Days, and I was helping with that, I got to know the mayor of Midway and a couple of other individuals in the valley, and they happened to be on the board of the Heber Valley Railroad. And in late 2011, during the economy downturn, the railroad was really in serious trouble financially. And they asked me if I wouldn't come and maybe offer a little advice, which turned into helping them write a business plan, which somehow turned into a little consulting gig, and somehow I'm still here 6 years later.
That's interesting. Mark, we have to wind this up, but we're so pleased to have you there and have the Heber Valley Historic Railroad part of the Heber Valley. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, coming up, we have Honey and Blaine Parker. We're going to talk to them, but first, we have a couple of underwriters.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
This is Stephanie, store manager at Jan's, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Jan's carries skis from brands like Atomic, Fisher, and Kessley, plus custom boot fitting to ensure boot comfort on the slopes. We also offer rentals of snowshoes, snowboards, and clothing. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have brought new guests in. Honey and her husband, Blaine Parker, are in studio now. They've launched a business called Couple Co., working with your spouse for fun and profit. Somehow that doesn't seem possible. So let's find out about that. Welcome to the program this morning.
Thank you. We've been doing it successfully for
almost 20 years.
Yeah. So, but yes, that what you said is actually one of the reasons why we started this, is it seems like anathema to a lot of people. Why would I work with my spouse? And one of the things we found was we have an advertising agency together, Slow Burn Marketing. And we've been doing this for about 10 years. And one of the things we've found is we work with a lot of couples, and really interesting couples who are crushing it. And it's great. And we thought, well, this whole working with your spouse thing is a really underserved market. There just isn't that much stuff out there. So we thought, we got to do something with this. What's it going to do? And it has turned into a podcast. And we are live on iTunes. And it's eventually going to be expanding out into other materials. There's going to be a membership site, resources for couples. We're going to be partnering with a psychologist to bring some more dimension to this. You're smiling at me like you want to say something.
No, I'm just smiling at you because you're so handsome.
Oh, and this is one of the secrets behind working with your spouse for fun and profit.
I understand that you'll be taking this on the road as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've started doing that. We have the Couple Coach, which is an RV, 25 feet long, which is all you need.
Some couples might argue with that.
We did Napa in November. We had a few couples there. One of those podcasts is already up. That's Wah Family Vineyards. And one of the next podcasts that's coming up is Mad Fritz Brewing. We interviewed them out there. They were great.
We actually interviewed one of our oldest clients, Dr. Sam's Eye Care in New Hampshire, which was a really interesting interview, which is up right now, at least half of it. We're doing most of the interviews are broken up into two parts. So there's a part one and a part two, and part two will be coming. Part one is live. But it's a really interesting interview because this is a couple that went through a lot of adversity in their business. And, you know, how do they keep it together?
And they were honest about it, which...
Completely candid.
You know.
Crazy.
We totally appreciate it.
You know, to me, it's not a surprise that the two of you started a company like this. You know, one of the things, I have been hosting, co-hosting My Own Money now for, I think, 8 or 9 years. I used to do it with Larry Warren. 4 or 5 years ago, you guys were a guest here for your Slow Burn Marketing.
Right.
And you also, I want to add and publicly thank you again. You also helped the station with some of our branding. People have seen the...
KPCW is one of our favorite pro bono clients.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. But for listeners that have seen, you know, KPCW, we have your Wasatch Back or KPCW only in Park City. We have the two of you to thank for that. So I want to...
All our fault.
Thank you for that. But my observation when we interviewed you is we don't have a lot of husband and wives that run a business that come in as guests, but it's not unusual. It's probably once a month, maybe mm-hmm. twice a month. And one of the takeaways that I had from the two of you is it seemed like you really enjoyed working together. Has that always been the case, or were there some foundational skills you had to work through?
I think our foundational skills came when—so we started in Los Angeles, and the first thing that we did together business-wise was screenwriting. We were a screenwriting couple, and we sold, I don't know, 4 or 5 screenplays. And the first one, from my point of view—and this is where you get into the he said, she said—from my point of view, the first one almost broke us. Because, I mean, really upsetting to me. And I'm somebody, I came from advertising, big agency advertising. I was at Gray in New York, and I like how I pointed on the radio. I was at Gray, and so I'm used to working with a partner, but it was just different. And it didn't seem to bother him as much as it bothered me.
No, not nearly as much. It was, you know, certainly there were the challenges, but I think that this is one of the differences between men and women is we approach these problems and deal with them differently and then internalize them differently. And
I'm a baby in the bathwater kind of gal, that's how I was. And actually one of the things that made this work is he's not a baby in the bathwater guy. He's like, okay, this is the problem. Let's deal with this one problem, but it doesn't mean everything. And so I picked that up from him because I wasn't that way before. So that's one of the great things when you work with the person you love, because you love them for a reason. And one of the reasons is they've got these great qualities that maybe you don't have. And so I was able to pick some of that up from him.
And, you know, it's interesting you say that you haven't had many couples come in here who run businesses. We actually feel like we could do this entire podcast from Park City for a year without running out of businesses. And the first interview we did was Robin and Jim Whitney of Whitney Advertising. And they are fabulous.
I liked them before. I love them now.
Yeah. And,
you know, I think you're right, but the division of labor that you were talking about, I think, is while a company might be owned by a husband and wife, they divide and conquer, and one of them come in and talk to us.
Absolutely.
Which leads me to my question. You know, the two of you, mm-hmm. you're mentioning about having different skill sets. Can every couple work together, or are some couples just destined, not to?
I don't think they should. It's been very interesting for us. I mean, I don't know exactly what I expected when we started this. For us, I think it's been the best therapy we've ever had, you know, because you're in front of these couples who, and no, not every couple should do this, but some of these couples, they just, it makes them better couples. You have to be better at communicating. You can't be afraid to say something to somebody. You have to trust the other, you have to trust their skill set, because you're going to say, okay, you're going to run with this stuff, I'm going to run with that stuff. And you have to be okay with that. And I think it makes them better couples. But no, not every couple.
No,
not every couple.
When we were first floating this idea publicly and letting people know about it, I got an email from somebody I know who said that he'd love to start a business with his wife, but she doesn't trust him. She would insist not only on doing her work, but his work as well. She would second guess every decision he made.
Everything's amplified.
Yeah, which is no way towards a harmonious working relationship.
I think ego has got to be the biggest thing in this.
Ooh,
just
yes.
Absolutely gigantic.
If
especially creative and ego. If you're working in an advertising agency and let's say Honey has an idea and Blaine has an idea, how do you get these things to merge?
Option C.
Okay. That is one of our favorite tricks is option C.
Yeah.
We built a house up in Tollgate Canyon, and we were told, oh, this is the test of a relationship. It's like, no, this is not the test of a relationship. Writing screenplays together was the test of a relationship.
But option C is when I feel strongly about something and he feels strongly about something else. And what we've realized, and coming from creative, where we're constantly having to come up with ideas for things, you realize pretty quickly that that's not the last idea. There's always going to be more ideas. And option C tends to be something that we come up with together, and it's never a compromise. It's always better than what we had on our own.
Why I brought up the house, which might have seemed off topic, but we agreed early on that if somebody wanted one thing in the house and somebody else wanted the other, then we would compromise and go a third direction.
And it was
always
better.
And it worked out brilliantly every time, and we have brought that into the business, and it's great.
You know, I love the option C idea. Unfortunately, we're quickly running out of time. But I do want, before we go, is there one or two other high-level, big pieces of advice that you'd share with folks?
Well, I love that piece of advice that we got from the business dean.
This was great. We're going to be interviewing the dean from a business college back east. And I said, tell me something. If you were going to advise a couple on the one single piece of advice they should have going into this, what would it be? And he said, without pausing, do not devalue your partner's time.
It's very easy for me to say, you know what? Hey, Blaine can just knock that out in a couple hours, and you know, and just totally take the value out of it. And because everything's so familiar when you're working with your spouse, it's you kind of want to do that with your clients. And let me just give you can't. Everything has to have a set price.
And how about one more? Any other tidbit, piece of advice that you'd share with folks?
I'd say take time to celebrate, you know, because you're constantly working. There's constantly things going on, but you're with the person you love. It's the American dream. You've created something together, and take time to celebrate even the small stuff.
Now, the podcast is thecoupleco.com.
Yes, you can
on
go
iTunes,
there, and
yeah.
That will link you to iTunes.
And the website is coupleco.com.
Coupleco.com.
Thank you very much for appearing on the program today. It was fun to see, and it's fun to see the synergy between you and the how excited you are about this situation. It'd be fun for people.
It's
to
hard
get involved.
Not to be excited.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Fun.
Our thanks to Honey and Blaine Parker from Couple Co. We'll be back to wind things up in just a moment.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you. Back again. Thank you, Doug.
Yes, and I want to start off by thanking our great sponsors. We couldn't do a show like this without our corporate sponsors, without our underwriters, and they include Mountain West Bank, Jans Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Development with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And thanks to our guest today, Elizabeth Willard-Tams, also Blaine and Honey Parker, and Mark Nelson from the Heber Valley Historic Railroad. Great program. We hope that we missed Renee today. Hope she's back with us next week.
Yeah, hope she's feeling better. Bob, I want to go back to a comment you made earlier. I missed that. Did I hear you earlier? You were saying Vail raised their minimum wage?
Yes, it did. Yeah.
I know before it was a $10 an hour. What did they raise it to?
I'm just thinking it's over 11 now, 11 and a quarter, something like that. I don't remember exactly, but it's gone up as